I'm Bob Andelman, and this is Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll welcome an old friend and a modern radio legend, Cleveland Wheeler. Wheeler and Scott Shannon were the brains behind the original radio morning zoo format, the Q Zoo, in the Tampa Bay area, which they eventually exported all over the United States. So yes, pretty much everything you love and hate about morning radio can be traced back to Wheeler and Shannon. Stick around. We'll be going zoning in no time at all, commissioners. One of my first real magazine assignments after graduating college was writing a story for Tampa Bay Monthly about the unique chemistry between radio personalities Cleveland Wheeler and Scott Shannon. Now, something magical happened in 1981 when these veterans of the American airwaves came together to do a morning show at WRBQ Q105 in Tampa. The Q Morning Zoo was unlike anything to ever hit once sleepy Tampa Bay, or anywhere else at the time. The hosts were quick-witted, opinionated, and cash machines for the owners of the radio station. The Q Zoo, Wheeler and Shannon, plus the news department of Pat Brooks and later Roger Shulman, were an absolute phenomenon in the early 1980s. Mondays through Fridays, they were the water cooler talk of every office and construction site in the marketplace and school, outdistancing all the competition. I wanted to talk to Cleveland Wheeler, who I've known for all these years, about that time, so I've invited him here today. Cleveland Wheeler, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you very much, Bob. Good to see you, and you've not changed a bit since high school.
You're a good liar. Now, listen, Cleveland, I know that there have been countless stories written about you and Scott and the Q Zoo phenomenon, which, of course, went on many years after Scott left. But I just kind of thought it would be fun to capture it on video for people who maybe didn't live through it or heard about it or lived through it but didn't know that much about what actually went on. So that's kind of what I want to talk to you about today. Let's kind of start with how it came together. You and Scott did not know each other until you were both in Tampa. Is that right?
No, we knew about each other. As a matter of fact, we missed each other by about 10 months or so working at the same radio station in Nashville, Tennessee. And I was doing nights there, and then I was replaced by a guy named Johnny Walker, and then Scott Shannon came in to replace him.
Was that Johnny Walker red or Johnny Walker black?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of all colors.
So you actually met when you got to Tampa?
Yes, we first met, and that's kind of strange because with all the conventions and radio activity, it's really bizarre not to have just come by and somebody say, hey, this is Scott Shannon, Cleveland Wheeler. And we never met that way. The first time we met was when he came into WRBQ to be the operations manager.
And you were there. You had already been hired.
Yeah, I had been there 2 years, and I'd made a lot of strides in 2 years because Jack Harris was king of the market at that time and developed some characters and had some people working on my show, Johnson, the maintenance engineer and all. And they did a study, and it showed that Johnson was the most popular radio personality in the market.
Really?
Not Jack, but Johnson, the maintenance engineer. So that would kind of set the ground for going on my own to have more autonomy to doing things in the morning. And then, ironically, the time was just right because Scott came in as the operations manager, wanted to sit in on the show. He had been deprived of being on the air, and a guy like Scott, he had to be on the air. He worked for Mallrights in a big company in Washington, D.C., which later became Marriott, and they didn't like their program directors to be on the air. They wanted them to be off and dedicated to, behind the scenes and, running the show for all the people who were on the air. So, he really had that desperate urge to get back on the air. And he said, you mind if I sit in? I'm just going to sit here and just watch you do your thing. And then I may join in and we'll just see how that goes. And so in the beginning, he became the other one. Yeah, we would say, he'd say, when you open up the mic, just say, occasionally say, Cleveland Wheeler and the other one. Oh, okay. So it was, I don't have a name. Okay, that's fine. And then as things started gelling, he decided that it would be a good idea if he stayed. And we did a two-man morning show. It was not called anything in the beginning. It was just Cleveland and the other one. And then he said, now you can start calling me the Nearly Famous. So it was the other one, the Nearly Famous, no name. That lasted for about a month until we had our big, we sequestered ourselves in a hotel room at the airport, Marriott, and for 2 days. And we said, what's this going to be? What are we going to do that nobody's ever done before?
And how did you actually feel about the idea that he wanted to sit in on the show? Had you worked with a partner before?
Yeah, but only briefly. And mostly in the way of them being news people that would contribute one way or the other. If you had to have somebody to bounce off of, or if it was news content, topical matter that was in covered the news, I had someone there for that. But not really officially having a two-man morning show, a second person.
And so when Scott said, I'm just going to sit in here and, we'll just see how it goes, you probably were thinking, I really don't need you. Right? I mean, seriously, what was going through your head? I mean, I've known you now for 30 years, and I'm thinking that you were probably thinking, yeah, I really don't need your help, thank you. But, I mean, you're the boss, so I'm not going to tell you no.
Well, the first thing I actually thought was is like all radio people think, and as is true, I'm expendable. So we'll see what works. It's like I was thinking he's going to be in here and he's going to be looking at what's going on and who's responding to what. And as I generally still had control of the subject matter and the breaks, then of course, sometimes people were invited by telephone. Other times they weren't invited. They just called up and had something to say about that we just talked about. And so I thought to myself, yeah, he wants to just see what pulls the strings. Uh-huh. And then maybe or maybe not. Maybe I'll be included, maybe not. And maybe he thinks he can do it better. And he had had a lot of success being on the air. Of course, Scott had a very unique personality and was a very street-level type of presentation, could relate to a lot of people. And I learned a lot of tricks from him. He really fooled me for a long time. He would pick up on a story and just to warm the hearts of people who, would make mistakes, or people would make fun of the way they talk or a word they use and incorrect grammar or so on. He played on that to make people feel comfortable about it. And I thought, what a charm, man. When I figured it out, I went, just how brilliant is that, And for instance, there was a story one time about Yosemite Park, something they were doing in the park, and he said, what's this thing they're doing at Yosemite? went, what? big park up here in the northwest, Yosemite. I did what I'm doing now. Every time I think of this story, this scenario, I'm looking at him, I remember the expression on his face was just so deadpan, and he wasn't smiling like, I did this on purpose, so follow me. He wanted my natural response. Uh-huh. And this is the kind of thing that I learned from Scott that I've never had utilized on radio before, because you get programmed to being just a radio DJ, and you intro and outro the records and tell the time and temperature and the weather, that kind of stuff, or read the promotional announcements, and you don't need those special skills to get in touch with people.
Had either of you experienced any, not near the success you would together, but had either of you been particularly successful in radio at that point, or was it really the coming together of your personalities and becoming a partnership for those couple of years that really launched both of your careers to the big time?
Well, I think in terms of, for lack of a better term, big time. Yeah, that was the thing that really put us on the map. But Scott was pretty well known because he just had a connection, a way of connecting to people. There was, I think, Tampa Bay Magazine at one time did an article on him, and it was somewhere in the title was something they called him Golden Boy. And there's a reason for that. You know, it's like the thing I just mentioned, the subtlety of connecting with somebody on a very street level. He didn't make an excuse. He didn't try to fake it about having intelligence. Oh, he's a very intelligent person. He didn't fake that part of his air persona, though. But what he did do is go out of his way to be very natural and street level to people and speak on their terms. So he had a knack. He had a really good knack for communicating with people. And I think that you got to separate the two. Before that, I would say that WAPE in Jacksonville was it for me. That's how I got recognized most all of the United States for what I did there, which at the time the style was, I was playing music, and the style was Bosch Jock Radio.
What would that sound like?
You know, it's kind of animated and driven, and kind of that, you know, the DJ thing, you know. You know, 690 WAPE, Cleveland Wheeler. And, you know, it's that fast in and out type thing. You've got 7 seconds over the intro of a song, and you put 15 seconds worth of words in it. You know, that sort of thing. Scott, on a very different level. Again, intrinsically, he communicated very well. Very simple stuff, but he just had a knack for communicating. I think he was known best for that.
So you guys started together, he was the other guy, and then he was almost famous. And then when did he become, you know, when did it become Scott in Cleveland? When did it become the Zoo? And how did you, you know?
Well, I mean, I don't exactly know when he first said his name, but it wasn't very long. It didn't take but about a month or so for us to go through all this, what is this thing? And after locking ourselves in a hotel room for 2 days, what we did was we discussed the things that we liked, the things that inspired us individually to get into the radio business, the people we used to listen to, what it is they did that was so special, and what their benchmarks were, the way they said things. I mean, we got right down to, like, you know, who the callers were, if they had a lot of callers, and who responded to them, and what their relationship with their caller was, and the banter between them, that sort of thing. And we put all this stuff down on paper, and we said, you know, what is it we could do then that would appeal to people from 8 to 80? Basically, that's how we lay it out. Ooh, you know, then we look at each other and go, ooh, pour another scotch. You know, because, I mean, why? Who would want to do that, first of all? And because, you know, Arbitron rates by demographics. And, well, what demographic cell were we going for most of all? The broadest thing was 25-54. You know, so, and you want the money demographic, naturally. So, you know, that's what we're supposed to target. But we figured if we can please somebody at 8 years old, somebody's going to go to mommy and go, what does that mean? Why are they laughing so much? And what does this word mean? And so on. And somebody at 80 that responds, it's grandma responding to what she sees her grandson laughing at. And in between, the parents are laughing. Everybody gets it. And so we knew we had to go to the line a little bit, but because it's skewed so young, you know, there's a part of that where you stop short of getting to the place where it's, you know, it's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. So all those considerations went into developing this thing that we had to attach a name to, which is sort of like, you know, let's say a menagerie. Because of the age spectrum we were going after. And so we're going farm, the monkey den, the crazy house, the flake factory, whatever. But we'd heard variation of most of that, but had never heard, with the exception of KZEW in Dallas, the word zoo spoken translation. That was mostly the moniker of the entire radio station rather than a morning show. So we came up with Zoo. And what's it going to be? Q Zoo? Q Zoo, sure, that's good. Okay, Q morning zoo. Now, Q-Zoo in the morning. Now, so naturally, we just called it Q-Zoo in the morning or Q-Zoo, but we had a lot of variations in the jingle, Q-Zoo in the morning. Then we had the Q-Zoo song that John Ritter did, wrote for us. And so it was whatever best suited a conversation, to say it in short or say it long or whatever. Everybody knew what it was when the word zoo came out attached to it. I would say it was shortly after we came to using the word zoo in whatever its earliest form was that Scott began identifying himself by his name. But most of the time, he still preferred to be in Scott the Nearly Famous or Scott the Other One.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for people who might be, let's say, under 30 right now, that can't imagine this, at the time, the early 80s, I mean – there were maybe there were half a dozen Sirius radio stations in the market that were competing. There were maybe four or five TV stations. Cable TV was just barely, you know, coming through. Right? There were not a lot of entertainment choices. So when you said you wanted to go after 8 to 80, that probably made a lot of sense. Even though the money, you know, the money group is the 25 to 54. If you've got everybody listening, if everybody is talking about you, you're going to get those people.
Yeah, because you've got layers of people that will support something you said. And if, you know, later on when the endorsements came, for instance, people wanted us to talk about their product and all that. We had to be very, very selective because as goofy as we were, we could have as much credibility that we didn't have. I mean, it's like saying Saturday Night Live has credibility. Well, of course it does. As what it does, it does. But I mean, if they were to do the Bass-O-Matic and you really thought that was a commercial, you know, that kind of thing, they wouldn't have a lot of credibility.
Right.
And sell you something, actually collect money for it. So we had to be very careful about things like that. But, you know, I think that the show actually, I think that it came around when we had people to get back to us and tell us exactly what we said. When they started doing that, we knew we were really on to something. And as you said, there wasn't a lot going on in the market. We used to term the market as being asleep. Oh, we're over here making noise and the rest of the market's asleep. Now, I mean, there were some exceptions to that. You know, at the time, 98 Rock was making its own kind of noise. Most of that was music. And there were personalities associated with that, but they weren't really doing anything in particular except selling the music and talking about their knowledge of the music and that sort of thing in that sort of way, you know. Uh-huh. It was very subculture-ish. And then later on, of course, there was Ron and Ron, and so and they hyper-entertained that audience. But we never had much direct competition. Unless you would want to say that Jack Harris was, and at that time, the early part of that, Jack was, FLA was middle of the road, as you used to call it. And it was just a lot of stuff, light, not offensive, not abrasive music. and Jack was informative, and of course, he was just Mr. Hometown.
Right.
So it was a different kind of thing altogether. And we were more into the entertainment aspect of it. I mean, we knew we were entertaining. It wasn't just, you know, as Jack was entertaining, but I guess what I'm saying is that we really worked on that aspect because other than the music, what do you have? Between the records, what really counts? And that's the product we were developing.
Right. You know, in fairness, I mean, Jack is himself a legend in the Bay Area. He's still on the air in the mornings. People love him. He's been around forever, and I'm assuming that you remained friendly with him, and you know that we don't want to take anything away from him. But it was a different kind of show, and Jack's always been a funny guy, sense of humor. But you know the formats were different, and the expectations were different. What was the moment, if you can think of one? What was the moment when everything changed for you? Do you think?
Well, the first rating book.
Oh, was that it? Yeah.
I mean, let's look at those days. You know, you had a lot of radio stations, but they weren't micro niched. You know, you didn't have all those alternative type formats and three different flavors of those and three different brands of country and, you know, the maverick country kind of thing, the new country kind of thing, the old legendary country, you know, and now everything is little slithers of pie. And back then it was like there was one big country station that was QYK, you know, and there was FLA, and that was a thing of its own, and that was kind of the hometown brand. I really think that I was really always impressed by FLA. It was clean, it was bright, it was not offensive, you know, it's not the kind of radio I liked doing, but I appreciated it for what it was. And then you had DAE, which was kind of their competition. And but these are big slices of pie here. And everybody has room enough to increase their slice of pie. And so as a consequence, when we first, I think our first book was a 18 or 19 share of the market, which that's what we were. Whoa. Well, now you step back about 15, 20 years. Before that, you had all the AMs, WLCY and all that. So, you know, they were used to having 75 shares of the market, especially at night. With their night, it was all kids. Every kid in town listened to LCY or ALT or whatever it was. And then as things grew, the numbers were harder to get. The big numbers were harder to get, but they were still attainable. Uh-huh. So when we get a 19 share, we were just, I mean, everybody was partying, you know? But by about the, by the time that Scott left 2 years later and went to New York, I believe that we just received the results of a book, and it could have been a winner book. Where we had a 24 share.
Wow.
And that was just, oh. Well, actually, when Scott left, I'm trailing off into some future territory here, but when he left, people went, well, that's it for the zoo. It's over now. You know, what's Cleveland going to possibly do? Who is he going to put in there? You know, it's just like, and of course I agree. I mean, there's not going to be another Scott Shannon. I don't know of one. I don't know of anybody that exists that had the same qualities he did. And then I'm thinking to myself, oh man, what am I going to do? Now this is going to be, it's really going to be in my lap to try to find somebody. And I just, you know, all the naysay stuff out there. I'm going to ignore it, first of all, because whoever I bring in, no matter how good they might be in their own right, they won't be Scott, and people will immediately compare them. It's like breaking up Martin and Lewis, which they did themselves, and bringing in another Martin or another Lewis. It wouldn't have happened.
Right.
It wouldn't have happened. So, you know, I just laid off for a while. And then came the idea to run a contest. I thought, here's a diversion. You know, it's like wagging the dog. So I decided to run a contest to have people to enter with a cassette tape. Remember those?
I remember 8-tracks. Yeah.
Why? Yeah. So, you know, I just said, I got on the radio and I said, look, send a cassette tape of no more than 5 minutes of what you would contribute to the Q Morning Zoo if you had a job here. Because we're going to give away a job. And no, it's really going to be a job. I mean, I'm not kidding. It's not like you come in here for a week or two or a day to be a jock for the day. No, it's going to be a job. And then people start calling up, going, well, what? I don't know what to put on the tape. Now, well, what's this job going to be? I mean, oh, you mean a title? No, we don't have any title. There's no title. But I'm going to be a title. Okay, if you want a title, we can, you know, make you the head of funny stuff. Whatever. I wrote a bunch of titles up and I said, well, I picked from one of these. Whatever. We'll have a plaque made. We'll put it on the door for you. Oh, I get an office? Sure. You know, what does this pay? I said, nah, well, I got to check with some people. So I went downstairs. I said, this is getting pretty popular. There are a lot of phone calls on this. I don't have as many entries as I do phone calls because people are like, what am I going to do? You know, you think, the average person thinks, I can do that job. People say I'm funny at work and that kind of thing. And then when it gets down to it, somebody says, in 5 minutes, you only get 5 minutes, just show me what you do. I want to hear your stuff, you know? So I had to start having to make examples of stand-up comedy or skits, likening them to Saturday Night Live, voices, dialects, things like that, parodies, celebrity stuff, you know, and mimicking celebrities. And finally, the tapes started rolling in. We got about 350 tapes. And of those tapes, there were about 15 people that qualified in their timing, you know, being quick-witted, sounding like they're unrehearsed and spontaneous. And of those 15 people, we narrowed it down to 5. It was pretty easy to do that. And we ended up selecting Bill Connolly. And Bill came in, and we quickly named him the show producer, which is kind of a, you know, it's not exactly an accurate title. His producer is thought to be, in radio particularly, a producer is someone who stands behind you with a clipboard and tells you what to do in your next break. Like, I've only been in the business 20 years. I think I know what to do in the next break. No, we don't need one of those. We need a creative guy. So I would start saying, okay, well, here's the topic here. Let's do this. Let's have a character, because Bill was a master at voices and dialects, and he was just, there wasn't anything he couldn't do. And I said, we need a guy named, a really edgy sort of guy that's really upset about the environment. And but he doesn't know anything about it. He doesn't know how to say environment. Skeeter Man. Yeah, that's his name, Skeeter Man. And Skeeter Man would be a real edgy sort of guy like that, you know. And he would go back and just master it. Man, he would just nail it. And you could put the idea of what it was going to be, what the punchline had to be, how to arrive at it, sort of, just sketchy. And Bill would write it. He would just write it, and like I said, he would nail it every time. There wasn't anything he couldn't interpret from just being in the room 30 seconds between songs to put something together, and he'd have it out in 20 minutes.
And what was Bill doing at the time? I mean, I know Bill. He's a great guy. What was he doing at the time you found him, though?
Bill was working for a label company in St. Petersburg.
I know the name of the company. Over, they were on Ulmerton Road there.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, only he was before that, or maybe even while he was working there, he was doing some stuff for Disney. He was doing artwork for Disney. And he's an aspiring cartoonist. And I say aspiring, it's really like he's, I don't know if I'm giving anything away or not.
I don't think you're supposed to say. I know. He's working as a professional cartoonist now in a ghost position.
Yes. A very big one.
You and everyone sees his work every day. It's about the best we can say, I think.
That's right. Somebody else's name is signed to it because that's the person who's
paying the bills.
A long time.
Yes.
Yeah. But he did the artwork on the Kuzu cookbook, which, of course, we put together for the proceeds to go to the building of what is now the Lowry Park Zoo, the new one, from the old one. And he's just a master at everything. He knows how to play every instrument. He's an incredible guy. But, I mean, I couldn't have asked for it. He was just a godsend. Mm-hmm. And all that was a diversionary tactic. But to get back to the part I left out, I had to go to Michael Osterhout, the general manager at that time, and say, Michael, this thing is getting big. We really want to offer a salary somebody can live on. We don't want this to be, because we expect somebody to be in for the morning show for 4 hours, and that's all it really has to be. But once we get this person in the station, who knows what the capabilities are, and everybody will want them. And we'll have him producing commercials for clients and everything else, and he can't just leave and come back and leave and come back. So let's offer a pretty decent salary. And, you know, we got the, it was for 1984, I think it was. It was a pretty decent living wage. And, he went on then. When I left, I departed to go to Houston, then came back, and and opened a business in Chicago, a consulting business, and then came back to PYK. By that time, he had joined Mason when Mason went across the street to Mix.
All right. Now you're getting way ahead of the story.
Okay.
So let's come. No, that's all right. Let's come back. I want to go all the way back to Scott, because even though it was only 2 years of your life, it was a very important 2 years for you guys, for radio. You guys took off like a rocket for 2 years. You had incredible ratings. It comes a point where I guess Scott announces that he is going to leave. And what do you think? I mean, or how did you find out that there was going to be a big change?
This is the way, my version, this is the way I tell it. Okay. We would go to conventions or radio gatherings. And every time we go to a convention, of course, Scott holds court. People gravitate towards Scott. He's a magnet, you know. He worked in the promotion business, record promotion, like I did. Only he had a role that was, I think it was probably as a regional out of L.A. under Neil Bogart with Casablanca Records. A pretty coveted position at the time. Yeah, that label had turned out a lot of really good artists. And
Donna Summer, for one.
Summer was an avant-garde label.
Yep.
And I didn't work for such a slouch company. I worked for Arista in New York, and we had Barry Manilow and Melissa Manchester and the Outlaws and Eric Carmen, all those people.
Mm-hmm.
But Scott was a star in that role too. So anyway, he had a lot of allies, and like I say, he held court in the conventions and so on. And inevitably, we would come back from these conventions. First thing I would do is, no matter where we were, I would get in the pool. I would head for the swimming pool, and I'd have a drink, and I'd be so happy looking up at the sun, the blue sky, to be back in Tampa, going, man, there's no place like it. And this is the kingdom. You know what I mean? There's nothing like it. It's good to be king.
Yep.
So and I'd carry my phone with me to the pool, and I could always count on it ringing, and it would be Scott. Hey, man.
I know that voice. Yep. Hey, man.
I'm in the pool. I'm in the pool. Hey, we can go to Detroit. You want to go to Detroit? I go, why would I want to go to Detroit? I mean, really? No, big money, man. We got an offer. I'm perfectly happy here. I'm in the pool. Right. I don't have snowshoes on. I'm fine. You know, so this got to be a habit, and we would get offers out of every convention we would go to, because what we'd done, and people were listening to it, people would fly in for a kind of a work vacation into the market and sit there and do nothing but monitor all week long sitting at the beach. Mm. You know, and we'd hear about this from other people. Other jocks say, hey, our morning team and a program director were just on Tampa listening to you guys. You know, so naturally they thought if they could wave enough money at us, they'd just get the real deal. But we turned them all down. When this happened with Scott getting this offer, he didn't even call me.
From New York.
Right.
Right.
He didn't even call me. And I can't say I was really upset about it, except that he didn't call me. You know, that part. And, you know, I asked him one time, I just said, what is it about this one? This is New York. He goes, well, yeah, you turn them all down. You don't want to go anywhere. You like it here. I know you like it here. I go, well, you're not wrong about that. I said, but, you know, I may have had to really seriously think about New York. I mean, going from Tampa to New York, what it is, you know, you hit the ceiling in New York. Hopefully that's the goal. And if you do it, you come back in 5 or 6 years and retire on the beach in Tampa and get to come home again. You know, it's not like going to Atlanta or something. So it didn't happen. No hard feelings, anything like that. It was just like, you know, but naturally people would say to me, how come you're not going to Scott? You know,
Well, and the, I mean, the radio business, really, historically, even today, has always been you go to a market for a while, and then you go to the next market. You always get fired, and you always go to the next job. And right. Scott was very much in that mode, and you had found a place that you really liked, and you were comfortable. And I mean, stop me any time here, but you have ambition. You had, but you had ambition to do it where you already were, where you were comfortable, and he just wanted to keep going. And I guess, see, this is – I hadn't realized this before, that – you had turned down so many things that he had already brought to you. I can understand, I guess, that by the time New York came knocking, he was like, Cleveland doesn't want to leave. I'm just going to take it and go.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm quite certain that was the story. I mean, you know, like any two people that work as close as we did together, you have your differences and you have your falling out and stuff like that. And we had our share of those things, but by no means that it causes us to, you know, cause any venom there. So, you know, I always thought, well, if ever I want to go in that direction, I probably have a place somewhere. I always hoped. I think I did call him a couple of times when he went to and developed the thing in L.A., the pirate radio thing, which didn't work so well. It wasn't the right time for the concept of doing that hair band thing or whatever it was. And then went to New York to PLJ. Then I believe that I made contact with him a couple of times. That was long after it left P105. But, you know, it's just after deregulation and the Telecom Act in 96, there was a lot of, you know, big corporate appeal, and I guess most of that's for salespeople and management like that, but wasn't the same thing to people who were on the air. So, you know, I called Scott and he goes, "No, man, you don't want to come here." He says, "Yeah, I got jocks who live in three in an apartment to be able to afford to live in New York, because, you know, this job pays $30,000 a year." I'm going, "You got to be kidding me." "No, they're living in the Bronx, you know, they're living in Queens." And so just barely making it. I'm going, "I can't go through that stage again, you know, not even for New York, not for the glory, you know."
Right. Well, it's just, we'll kind of wrap up with Scott here, just so people know, people in Tampa Bay, people in New York know where Scott is. I think he just recently last year signed another multi-year deal with WCBS-FM, and he was at PLJ. He started Z100 in New York. And he's also, this I did not know until today, he is the voice of the Sean Hannity radio show.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hannity refers to him a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you, Scott Shannon or whatever. He actually gives him billing.
So strange. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here. I was under the impression that while you two were here, or maybe this came later, that you did consulting for other stations and exported the Zoo format to other cities, or did that not happen until later, or was that just Scott did that? I thought it was the two of you.
No, it's a slightly complicated story. Nobody, ironically, in our company, bunch of nice guys, well-intending people, whatever, you would just think that everybody would be on the mark about this when they, especially when they saw the word zoo pop up around the country with morning shows. There was no way for us, even though everybody knew we started the zoo kind of thing. Nobody is so proud in radio that they don't steal everything.
No. Radio? Really? Thieves?
It is just the biggest thieving business. It really is. And I say that with no respect. Really, it just is what it is, okay? But TV does it in a different way. You know, if you get a hit show and it's got like a Chinese guy and a girl, a flippy little girl with red hair, and then this crazy boss guy or whatever, and it works, then all the networks somehow put the same characters in another show that's almost identical. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, I don't know, this duplication of things, that's where radio is now. And so I don't know.
I was going to say, the thing I always found interesting about radio is TV, one TV show reaches across the nation. Up until really recently, one radio show did not reach across the nation. It was heard locally in your neighborhood or in your metropolitan area, and that was really it. I mean, you could know and love the Q Zoo in Tampa, but go to Miami and they don't know who Cleveland Wheeler or Scott Shannon is. Or for a long time, I mean, I guess the guy who really broke through that was Stern. Really, he was the guy who took his show from New York to Philadelphia to, I don't know, Chicago, where Boston, wherever he went.
Right.
But really, radio, for the most part, still is a small town medium.
Well, is there a lot of plugins? There are a lot of things to choose from. Of course, it's a cash crop corporation, because these plug-in things don't cost anybody anything at all. And they hope they can go out and sell them as being this national identity thing plugged into a local market, which I still have. I don't know. I don't know if I buy that so much. And that's why we turned it down. We got an offer to do that in 1983, the year before Scott left. We met with a guy named Randy Jeffries, who was he brokered stations for sale and so on and did syndication. Now, I can't even recall what kind of syndication he did back then, 1983. There wasn't much of it, and satellite was not a word that was even spoken of too much. It was like, I just remember we had satellite dishes outside the radio station, and the engineer was doing a lot of stuff for Disney and NASCAR and things like that. And, of course, we could bring down ABC Radio Networks, who we had an affiliation with, on those satellite dishes, but most of it was not stuff going up, you know. So to answer your question, though, a while ago when you were talking about like tutoring or consulting other radio stations, what happened was is that I thought everybody was missing the mark on not protecting the show. So I hired my own private copyright attorney, and it took me 3 years, but I copyrighted QZoo in the Morning, QZoo, whatever like that. Now, it would seem like that was an easy thing to do because it was unique, but the Copyrights and Patents Office had never copyrighted a radio show before. And that was a surprise to me. You've got to show what's so unique about it. I mean, radio is radio. It just like either happens spontaneous or it's a bunch of guys reading sports scores or, you know, that kind of thing. So I say, well, I mean, first, the most unique thing about it is that we write all of our own material. That wasn't necessarily true. I say it was probably an eighth of our material, and we would take some syndicated stuff and we would rip it up and use parts of it in our produced material sometimes, and not often. Sometimes there would be a song, a parody song or something like that came from one of our affiliate radio stations because, for instance, John Lander, who used to be on WLCY, when we bought that station, there was no longer going to be a morning show playing contemporary music. So Lander was put into our Houston station, KKBQ, where he was for 11 years. And then I replaced him in 91. And I think he went to Philadelphia or Boston or something like that. So, you know, we would plug in these people. They had their own style of doing the zoo. The moniker was the same, but the content was always different. Everybody had their own creative autonomy with what they put in the zoo. They understood what the goal was, but they created their own show. So anyway, after this happened and after Scott was gone, then I persuaded the owner of our company, Gary Edens, to, you know, at least like kind of have somebody to follow what was blatantly infringing. And that's when they started taking content off the show and using QZoo as the name, all that, I just wanted some cease and desist, friendly letters to go out, that kind of thing. That started getting pretty expensive. So, Gary decided that he was going to open up a new business in the company and allow me to consult different zoos and make it available to them to know exactly how to put the thing together, that it wasn't just a bunch of noises, bells and whistles, banging on drums and stuff like that, that there was an objective to this. So, you know, we put out a full page ad in Meridian Records and a nice color thing. I believe it was a slick of teddy bears that had Q-Zoo sweaters on. Hmm. And then we had one standing out in front of all the others. The others were wearing like blue sweaters. And this one was wearing a gold sweater and said Q-Zoo. And said, the title was All Q-Zoos Are Not Created Equal. And it's basically sold our little consulting package, which everybody just went, ha. You know, nobody took us up on that kind of thing.
I see.
Yeah.
So what were for people who missed that era, what were some of the moments for you that, you know, you remember best that left a mark for you? I mean, I referenced in the introduction Zonin. You know, of course, it's a bit of a parody song. And well, what were some of the moments that stand out for you from that era?
There's so many. It's like it's just a blur. It to me, when I think of now, it's been so long. You know, 10 years ago, it didn't seem like it was that far back. And now it just seems like, did I ever really do that? I've told friends that before. I just had a matter of fact. I was just in Tampa and visiting with about five or six of my old comrades there at the radio station, and they were talking about, God, remember when you did this and you did that? It's just incredible. Just nobody thinks about doing it. They don't have the permission to do it anymore. You know?
Right.
That's one way it's changed. A handful of people may. I don't know how they acquire that, but they got to know somebody or have somebody that really supports them. There's no support mechanism, no teams anymore that go, let them do it. Just let them go at it. It really is a cacophony of just like when you say that, so many things. But I just say that because you mentioned the zoning thing, that was the first notch on the pistola handle. it wasn't intended to be. We didn't say, Scott and I didn't get together and say, we're going to pick on politicians and we're going to round them up and pull them apart. And how do we even have resources to dig on people to do PI work and that sort of thing? But Scott was smart enough, and I hand this to him too. He said, you know, all the great stuff, all the great stories are hidden in the Saturday newspaper. Get the Saturday morning newspaper and it can look so insignificant. It can be this big and look so innocent. That's where the big stories are really hidden. They don't have the dirt yet, but they're putting just enough in there to say, we got to that first. Remember, that was just a little story?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we kept finding these things every Saturday morning in the Tampa Times at that time of, one was Joe Kotvas had to drive down a dirt road to get home or whatever. And he had a city car, okay? And the car got dirty every day. So he was one of these people who was obsessive compulsive about having his car clean, and he would wash his car every day. And the story was about how much the city of your tax dollars paid on washing his car, all right? Another thing was inappropriate bids or something with Jerry Bomer.
Right.
Then there was Fred Anderson, and I forgot what that had to do with. But, you know, it was all this shaping up, and it only took about 3 weeks. Well, we would just start out with a car washing deal with Joe and the shady deals with Jerry Bomer and that kind of thing. And then as the meat came into the story, week after week, it grew until it was like, you know, Joe, Jerry, and Fred. It was like the Three Stooges, and we'd use Three Stooges audio. You know, and sound clips from Three Stooges, comedies for them to answer questions, sort of like an old Dickie Goodman song, you know. So eventually there was a club up on Nebraska Avenue, a disco, and we were going to have it had reached a point where they indicted all those guys, you know, all three of them. And people were coming to us going, how did you know about this? They got all three of those guys, man. And I remember spending your tax money and washing their car. Yeah, I know. But, I mean, how did you know about all this other stuff? And instead of attributing that to the Tampa Tribune. They were attributing it to us, thinking, you know, we had a lot more inside clout than we did. As a result of that, we were invited to a lot of parties, a lot of, you know, that's where we came up with this, the term, the goober smoochers. We're hobbies, the goober smoochers. We're buying yachts and doing parties from people we'd never thought would ever invite us into their homes. And we threw a little party at this disco, a going away party for Joe, Jerry, and Fred. And we had a limo, and we had the limo with three people with bags over their heads. You know, made the announcement inside, they're here, they're here. And everybody ran outside, and they ran to the door, and there were crowds of people, and the limo pulled up, and these guys get out with bags over their heads and people. And that night, Joe Kotvas showed up at the party.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You're talking about self-deprecating. The guy really had a good sense of humor. He really was a good-hearted person. And I hated to see it happen in a lot of ways.
Well, I saw a video clip about that time, and Kotvas was actually interviewed, and he said that, you know, ever since you guys had started talking about his car getting washed all the time, he would tell people that they could either meet him at his office or meet him down at the car wash.
Right.
I thought, he seemed to have a good sense of humor. I don't know what else he did, but he had a good sense of humor.
Oh, he did. He did. And, of course, after he got back, when he got back to Tampa, and he opened up the hot dog stand there for a while and all that kind of stuff, I'd spoken to him several times, and he was very gracious. Balmer, that Balmer moved somewhere close to where I am back in that day, in near Tullahoma, Tennessee, and had a pig farm.
God. Well, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened over the years. You eventually things fell apart with the Q. You went to AM, which is where we met up again, and I remember coming and spending a lot of time hanging out with you in the basement of Q105 with I guess Ward Smith and Dan Chapelo, right? Also, and so we're not going to be able to cover everything, because also I know that your phone is going to die, but when we spoke a week or two ago, you were reminding me about, there was this one guy who showed up at the Q for a while, totally unknown. I think he came in as a producer. He wasn't there very long, but everybody knows who he is now. You want to talk a little about that guy?
Yeah, the guys who replaced me when we decided to, well, not we.
Yeah.
But the people who were brought in by the owner of the station when the Power Pig was making inroads on us. And mostly because it was very clever guerrilla marketing. As Randy Michaels was in charge of programming for, at that time, J-Core. And came to bought their stations, would talk about us on, he would just take over FLA and talk about all the people and all the inside information. They used to steal our memorandum from the garbage can and everything else. And so they had a certain amount of inside information and informants as well. And they would talk about affairs that were going on. All kinds of stuff, man. It was just a unique time. But anyway, it was decided at that time, for whatever reason and by whoever, that we should go head-to-head with them. So they brought in our program director from KKLQ in San Diego, and they had a similar audience. They had a lot of Hispanics, but, of course, there was a Mexican audience, and so a little bit different Hispanic demographic. So, but they felt he was enough in tune with this music to be able to successfully do that. I had gone to Costa Rica on a little respite for about 2 months and came back, and they all of a sudden they just like kind of thrust me into this loop about music programming and things that were going to come about and the changes that were going to come about. And I got to say, unless somebody bears me out, I'd hate to think this was done intentionally, but it seemed like a deception for my benefit, because all the things that were spoken of in terms of change never occurred. And matter of fact, they must have been having a separate meeting right after the ones I attended. And I got into the station after Costa Rica. I was off the air for about 2 weeks, came in, and as I was driving in that morning, I thought I was listening to FLZ. It was like thunking away, you know? And then I hear the break, and I'm going, no, this can't be. I get in, like, and everybody's just looking at me going, welcome back. Oh, I mean, Pat Brooks is going, oh, I don't know what's happened. What's happened? I'm going, I don't know. I thought you knew. I thought you were in the loop. And I'm going, oh, I thought I was too, but apparently. So anyway, the die was cast. I had a conversation, and it seems like the time was up for the zoo, and they were ready to move on and do new things. And I, of course, plaid didn't go with stripes, and so it was just totally out of place what I was doing with the music there for about the last 3 weeks. And they had hired a new team, Elliot and Voss, Mike Elliott and Kent Voss, okay? And these guys came in, and with them, they had a producer, the same kind of producer I spoke of that has the clipboard and said, okay, in the next break, you'll talk 30 seconds, and you'll do this promo, and you'll tell the time here, and then you move on to traffic and so on. Like they didn't know all that stuff, but they had a guy behind them telling them that, and that guy was Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's a fast track to fame, isn't it?
Did you cross paths with him much, or he was just there and then he was kind of gone? He wasn't there a long time.
No, he wasn't. And, in the hall, just really literally crossing paths from one room to another. And then I wasn't familiar with the name then. And one, I don't know, it didn't seem like it was very long after, a couple of months after he was gone. I'm tuning around cable, and I see this thing with Adam Carolla called The Man Show. And he would come out usually first before Carolla. And I'm going, God, that guy looks familiar. I know this guy from somewhere. And it's funny, it took me a long time to even figure out that he was, you know, the new morning team's producer.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just curious about that. All right, so as the years go on, you were at U92 for a while. You did QYK. That was people were very surprised. You popped up and were doing morning shows at the country station in town. Looking back now, I wouldn't have asked you then, but or maybe I did at the time. But was that an odd fit for you as you look back? Did you think that was maybe ill-fated from the beginning?
It didn't have to be, but boy, there were just so many different factors and internal factors and clashing personalities and things like that. It's sad to say, because I really enjoyed the people that I worked with there. But the people, you know, in management and so on had their own idea of how far things should go. The argument basically was, Bob, that I told them when it all came close to an end, I said, so you just really hired me for the marquee value. You wanted to put the name up there, but you don't want the content. Well, we got a different audience here. You didn't figure that out before you offered the job.
Right.
You know, and so I really don't take any responsibility on that one, because I had good numbers going out and I had good research behind me, and they would share that with me frequently and come in and go, yeah, it looks good, looking good kind of thing. And I was enjoying myself, and I had a certain free rein in the beginning to put people in the show like Les McDowell, who was a really true, genuine, natural talent. Mm-hmm. And, took him out of the airplane and out of traffic and stuff like that to be a part of the show. And John Ritter was, again, the guy who wrote the Q-Zoo song. Came on the show and helped out. And had its own flavor. Everything was natural and unplugged. You know, like John with the guitar to stand by and to do stuff and to do parodies right then, live. Nothing was produced on that show. We didn't go into the, like we did in the Kew Zoo. I didn't want anything to have a flavor of the zoo. Mm-hmm. And it had its own flavor. I didn't mind country music at the time because it had become very, very pop sounding. You know, with Martina McBride, and all the songs started sounding very, with the exception, of course, of the Accents Like That, you know. It had its own familiarity, and the audience was down home and relaxed and accepted me, and I had a good time there, all but for the end.
Well, yeah. Well, it's always the end that, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Do you want to – you had asked me to ask you to tell the story about U-92.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to share that? I you know, is there a short version to that story? That's a great story.
I don't know which part of it you're talking about.
Well, okay. So folks, one of the things, if you're not familiar with the way radio works, is you always know that you're just a day away from being fired in radio. It's just always – it happens. Whether you're Cleveland Wheeler or you're Joe Schmuck, you have no more job security no matter who you are. It's just the way it works. And so the story that we had talked about, that I recall anyway, is that you had decided at some point – you didn't want to renew your contract there, and you gave notice like 4 months ahead and said, listen, I'm going to go. And you had it in your contract that you needed to give notice or it was – so pick it up from there, if you will. Just tell what happened.
Well, say a little background on this is that we kind of got – it was in the air that there was something going on, that the station may be up for sale. Could never confirm that, but the talk was around on the inside that it was among the air staff. Of course, nobody would ever talk about it on the sales staff in front of us or – at the management level or anything like that. So you could never confirm it. But then we had these meetings where the owners of the company would come in, the owner being an older guy and and another one that was his son. And every time they came in, they would say, now, I know there's a lot of rumors floating around that we're going to sell this place, and that's not true. We appreciate the work of everybody here, and just keep on doing what you're doing, and thanks a lot, and bye-bye, and I'm going home. Okay, so we got that. And then all of a sudden it came down to another meeting where the general manager walked into the meeting and said, well, you know me, I can't stay in any place for too long, so I'm leaving. And no, that really doesn't. Well, anyway, but don't worry about it. Everybody's job is secure, and we're not selling the place. And then it was the program director. Hi, it's really been good working with everybody, but I'm going to move on, you know, to bigger and better things, the memo. And so bye-bye. But you've all got a good job here, and so don't worry about a thing. And then all the plastic comes up, and all the air conditioning ducts start coming down. You know what I mean? They start remodeling the place and going, oh, this place is for sale. And so I just decided, well, my contract's up in March, so I'm going to turn a notice. We didn't have a PD or a general manager, so I had to go to the fill-in, I don't know what you call him, you know, general manager at the time, who was a great guy. And so it was easy approaching him ahead of time, 2 months ahead of my contract expiration, and saying, I just wanted you to give you a heads up that I'm going to be out of here as of that date, probably the day before, because I think the contract falls on a Saturday technically, so I'll be off the air the day before, and bye-bye and good luck. And, why are you not renewing your contract? I said, because I think you're going to sell the place. Looks like this place is for sale, and by now the rumor was around that it was CBS that was buying it, and of course that came to pass. So anyway, I turned in my 2 months notice, and I said, I am, however, aware that I'm legally bound to give you a certified letter telling you this, too. I said, but, let me get with the owner. I won't say his name. Let me with the owner and see what he says, and I'll get back to you. Never got back to me. And then it seems like about 3 weeks later, I said, oh, by the way, my notice still applies. I just wanted to remind you, did you ever hear back from the owner? No, I haven't heard. And I found that a little strange. All of a sudden, the day before I'm supposed to leave happens, and out in the lobby is the office manager and the acting general manager, whom I'd given the notice to 2 months ago. Can we see you a minute in the office? I go back there, and they're looking at me all solemn-faced and going, leave, and we're going to have to terminate you. So I mean, you're going to be kidding. And I'm laughing, and they're just looking at me like this, you know. I'm going, you are kidding me, aren't you? Really? I gave you notice 2 months ago. You're terminating me? You know? So I don't know. It saved me a couple of cents in severance pay or something. I can never figure it out. But things stranger have happened in radio.
Right. And I think the reason I wanted you to tell it is certainly any radio people who will watch this or listen to this will go, yep, I know those stories. You know, it's so common. What is it about radio that these things happen all the time?
I don't know. There's a certain detestable nastiness. It just happens out of the blue. You get along with people so great for 2 years there, and all of a sudden, for no reason, that has to be the way things are done. And I just assumed that those decisions were made at the top. Well, this, tell him he's fired. Wait till last day. And why? I don't know. I thought I was being, you know, super nice by giving, you know, right, 2 months notice to give them time to do something. But obviously in a sale like that, they take it personal sometimes because you're looked upon, especially, I mean, I thought I had pretty good numbers there, as good a number as you can have playing a cheesy oldies format, you know, sugar, sugar. I thought the sugar, sugar format, it's a very sweet oldies format.
Oh, yeah.
And by that, I mean, the radio people will know, but, you know, it's when they select the songs that make the sound of the radio station. So in that case, it was kind of a bubblegum sounding oldie station. But, you know, I don't know. I guess that's just the way they wanted it to happen because they figured that I'm an asset to the sale and I'm leaving. So why is he leaving? Is he dissatisfied? No, there's a bunch of plastic there. And tell you something. I don't want to work for the next owner. I want to go do something else.
Right.
You know, but it doesn't suffice in that situation.
All right. All right. So let's wrap up here because we've been very lucky that your phone battery has held out. Last thing I want to ask you, and I'm curious about this because I saw that you were asked this question over 30 years ago, and I'm curious to know how the answer matches up. Very simple. What do you want people to remember about Cleveland Wheeler?
It is still the same answer, and because that was the whole purpose of the show. If you're going to remember him, hopefully it's the radio guy and not the guy so much in his private life, although they're very similar, and that would be that they laugh.
You are correct, sir. That is exactly what you said in 1983. I checked.
Very good.
That's great. Well, Cleveland, listen, well, folks, listen, if you're curious about those days, the Q105 days, the early days with Scott Shannon and Cleveland Wheeler, or later, there's also they had something called ZooTube. There's some clips from that. You can go on YouTube and you can search Q Morning Zoo, Q105, Cleveland Wheeler and Scott Shannon, and you can find, surprisingly, there's quite a few clips from that era. So if you're not familiar with it, you can go and see it. We'll probably have some here on the page on MrMedia.com. But Cleveland, can people find you on Twitter or Facebook, anything like that? Are you available?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, and I've got quite a few friends that are listeners. I'd say probably a third of the people on there on my Facebook page are former listeners of the zoo, and I get them every day. You know, I don't recognize a lot of names, and I say, I'm just curious. How did you find me? I look at the friends that they're friends with, that I'm friends with, and I don't recognize any of them either. So unless we're, you know, the FBI or DOJ or something, I don't know. I assume they're former listeners.
You're sure it's not Mason Dixon sending you listener spam or anything, right?
Mason and I, we got back together. You know, we broke up, and and we exchanged the olive branch with each other a while back, about a couple of years ago, when there was a Tampa Bay radio reunion. He had me on the show, and we talked about being gay lovers and the old days.
I didn't get into Mason because I knew there was an issue there, and I just thought, well, you know. But I figured we better mention Mason because maybe he'll listen to this and be like, that son of a bitch didn't mention me once.
Well, you know, he created it all.
Oh, we love you, Mason. You know that. Yeah. Well, Cleveland, my friend, it's so good to see you. It was great to have the opportunity to talk about Ow, okay. That must be Bright House telling me it's time to go. Cleveland, it is great to see you. It was really great to talk about old times, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Turn your back on the deceiver. It's a bad idea to believe her. A bad idea to believe her. Turn up the stereo receiver. Turn up the stereo receiver.
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of grown-ass men and women who remember the thrill of turning on the radio in the morning and never knowing what craziness was about to unfold in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.